This episode is brought to you by Reese's Peanut Butter Cups. In breaking news, leading scientists worldwide are conducting experiments to determine if Reese's Peanut Butter Cups are the perfect combination of peanut butter and chocolate. However, it appears the study was inconclusive, as the scientists couldn't help but eat all the Reese's. Because when you want something sweet, you can't do better than Reese's. Find Reese's now at a store near you.
Quit laughing.
I'm trying.
Welcome to Gola. I'm Katie Parla, a Rome-based food and beverage writer, culinary guide, and cookbook author.
And I'm Danielle Caligari, an assistant professor in Italian at Dartmouth College and a certified specialist of wine.
Ciao. What is going on, Danielle?
Ciao, Katie. I'm excited. We haven't just recorded a regular old podcast in a while. We've had a lot going on. We did all kinds of super fun live events with our fans. So many of you who are no doubt listening and enjoying this new episode with us were there to support us and hang out and just have a great time. We enjoyed it so much, in fact, that we are going to do more for sure. So look out for those. Couple of things on the horizon, including some work with wine from Campania, which, as you already know, we are super jazzed about. And what else, Katie?
Well, I like wine from Campania, so I'm super stoked. We're also going to get like a very spirited, fun pack going with Amphora Wine Merchants, who we've collaborated with before. So definitely stay tuned for those collabos. And just as we did with our, you know, sparkling packs and things from Beyond Divino, we'll be recording podcasts to accompany those offers, which you can listen to whether you buy the stuff or not. So no presh, but maybe a little presh to support us in another way. We have just launched a Patreon or Patreon account, depending, I suppose, on where you learned English. And you can support us there at patreon.com/golapod. You know, as Danielle said, we've been rolling out a lot of online events and different Zoom things and collaborations. And it's just been so, like, such a joy in a somewhat dark time to have Gola to look forward to and to get so much love from our beloved Golozi. So already we've got some wonderful patrons that you can join. Patrons?
Well, I think the people are patrons. Okay. The site is Patreon and or Patreon. And we have levels defined just for our Golos, our world of Golosita. And that includes the first level at Goloso. If you have $10 a month, you can join as a patron and get access early to just about everything. And also special material from us that we'll be providing slowly. And in particular, in addition to, or kind of as an appendix to some of these special events or the items that we'll be tasting along with in those cases. So if you are already supporting us on Anchor, like so many of you are, we are going to do a roll call in a moment of all of our old school, most beloved Golozi. Think about moving over to Patreon and becoming a formal patron with us, because in that way, we're going to be able to give you a lot more bang for your buck. And we'll slowly be moving away from Anchor and towards Patreon and our new podcasting platform of Squadcast, also to bring higher quality audio at last and a smoother transition to the podcast platforms that you're all using.
Totally. Ask and you shall receive. People said, step up your audio game. And we've been doing baby steps all the way to maximum quality ever since.
All the way to maximum quality.
Maximum quality.
It is our ultimate goal. And to that point, you can also, even if you're feeling really saucy, some of you have already started supporting us at the higher level of Giotto or Giottone, which allows you to also have, for example, your business supported on Gola and gives us the opportunity to spread the good word about your amazing products. In that case, we have right now already our wonderful friend Leah Ferrazzani at Semolina Artisanal Pasta, who our listeners already know because we had a phenomenal live event with her that was really well attended and that gave us a chance to talk about quality pasta and the labor behind it, which made us really, really happy. So check out Semolina Artisanal Pasta. You'll hear us touting the fantastic products from Leah more and more on the show because she is our first and best Giotto. We also have a series of other new supporters we want to shout out today, including Alex DeLuca, Ryan Muglia, Carol Orton, Todd Reed, Steven Scarpula, or Scarpula. I don't know how people in America say their Italian last name.
I just imagine that he says it Scarpula.
We really hope that it's extra authentic every time. And speaking of that extra authentic pronunciation, our new friend Bobby Mazzullo at Mazzullo Pizza in Sacramento, who not only supports us as a new patron and not only is a longtime listener and great supporter of the podcast, but also showered me with pizza gifts when I was recently in Sacramento. And I must emphasize how incredibly excellent this place is. And I want everyone who's in the greater Sacramento area ever sometime in the future when we start moving around again to get there, try some pizza and enjoy the amazing hospitality at Mazzullo. I had a wonderful time. I can't wait for Katie and I to get back together, maybe even do a live pod while we're getting those pizzas slanged right in front of us.
Love it. Lots of West Coast support going on. I'm into it. And
yeah,
a big, big, big shout out to the Anchor supporters. Should we do our roll call?
Yeah, we have to, you know, so we're letting everyone know about Patreon and we're so excited to move over and to streamline this and make your support into clear material for you from us. But we can't forget that there have been so many of you hanging on with us from the very beginning, even when things were a little rough and tumble, and still here through Anchor with us. And we are just so, so grateful. I know we say it all the time, but we wanted everyone to get a shout out today. So Katie, you want to take it from the top?
You betcha. Grazie infinite to Agresta Abigail, Amy Cahill, Marco De Vito, Bianca Di Fazio, Julianne Farraker, Anthony Ferraro, Kim Force, or Force. I know it's Force, but I want to say it with the Italian pronunciation. Camilla Jorgensen, Pamela Kerpius, Lauren Kluhr, Jan Kubik, John Nolan, Joge, the one and only Carla, Michael Parla, Ross Phillips, Leon Rossi, David Rubaltelli, Ali Ruggiero, Jackie Sayet, Alyssa Scott, Ellen Schick, Kevin Schreiber, Ron Smith, Catherine with a K and a Y, Strickland, into that spelling, Sarah Tarnopolsky, Eric Tognetti, Judy Wally, and Guanyang. We appreciate you so much. Thank you. And
those are,
we would love to get into also the whole entire like warm outpouring of love that was showered upon us via PayPal and Venmo during our live events. But we're going to do that roll call in our next podcast so we can do some special attention for you guys who were so generous with us. TBD.
Yeah, we have to leave room for everybody, and it's going to take us some time because there are so many of you, and we're overwhelmed by it. Honestly, I mean, we were going back through and seeing the people who have been throwing us cash from the very beginning. As usual, I was moved into my weepy state, particularly during these trying times. But we're also seeing more and more people jump on, and as the community of Golosi grows, we will grow with you. So anybody you can recommend the podcast to, any time you have to subscribe or give a little extra cash, any moment you take to give us a review online and let everyone know how much you're enjoying, all of that helps tremendously. And Katie and I have already made a huge leap toward being able to do more things. You've seen it. These live events are happening, the collabs with our friends in wine and spirits and in fine quality Italian food products like olive oil and pasta. Those are all coming from your support directly. You can draw a straight line right there. So the more we have, the more we'll do for you and with you. And we're really looking forward to it. It has been a rough year, but also an exciting one. And we thank you and can't wait to keep it up and keep doing even more.
Yeah. And, you know, because it's been such a challenging time, we wanted to do a really uplifting subject for our podcast. Just kidding. I mean, you knew I was kidding, right? It's a disease-driven one, but it's so interesting. It's so interesting. And as you know, we love connecting transatlantic trade and agriculture, agrarian crises, government mismanagement, insane asylum, construction, development. These are all passions of ours. So you may have already guessed the subject of our episode is corn.
Corn.
You'll never look at buttered popcorn the same way again. Danielle, I love corn a lot. I love corn products. The way that I encounter them generally is I buy corn at the farmer's market and I pop it in a pot on my stove. I eat polenta. I eat cornbread. And that's what I'm in Italy. In the U.S., I eat grits. I'm into corn. But it's not just a delicious ingredient. There's a lot of history behind it. There's a lot of tragedy behind it. So let's break it down. Let's talk about how corn reached Italy in the first place.
Well, this is one of my favorite topics as well, maybe less so for all of the disease and danger that it brought. Ooh, and more so for the chronological line that it draws for us culinarily. You know how much I love to be able to kind of trace out these broad themes historically through food. And corn is a great one for us because corn is an item that we can, first of all, kind of have a hard start and stop for. It's a new world food, and we know that it wasn't in Italy in, for example, my area of concentration, the medieval moment, or before that in the ancient world. We have corn arriving in Italy and the rest of Europe just when you would suspect it, with the transatlantic trade, the Columbian exchange of foods that were native to the Americas and brought over initially almost always just for curiosity at first, and then kind of developing, depending on how well they did in certain climates and certain territories and certain soils, into a more popular product. And then vice versa, of course, things that were sent over to the Americas that became popular there. Corn is one of those things that has a kind of, or receives a kind of delayed reaction. Like almost, there's really no food that doesn't have a kind of a slow growth in terms of its cultural cachet in Europe. But corn definitely is available from the 16th century, so 1500s when you would expect, but it doesn't really become hugely popular until later, particularly in Italy, as political shifts make it necessary to find alternatives to wheat. And we should, you know, put a pin in that because we're going to come back to other grains in the course of our next podcast episodes. And everyone who's interested in these themes will get answers to some of those questions, although don't hesitate to shout us out in questions or comments on Instagram or elsewhere if you have them as you're listening to this, and we'll get to you somewhere along the line in these episodes or through our own posts. But corn fits into this larger scheme, right? It's something that fills in that space.
So is it true that, like, Columbus brings it back with him on his first trip returning from Mesoamerica, or is that more of like a cultural myth? And do we think that if that's the case, that it would have sort of traveled from the Iberian Peninsula through South Italy first?
Yeah, that's the first answer to that is we can't be 100% sure of the path that these things took, because it's also true that while Columbus was the first in some ways to reach these territories and to kind of effect an exchange, and it is true that he documented things in a more in a clearer way, it's also the case that shortly thereafter the world explodes, right? It's only a matter of a few years before circumnavigation is happening, and a series of other people are back and forth, and we start moving. So especially when it comes to popularization, it can be a little bit hard to trace. There are, and you know this, Katie, because I think we've talked about this with wine, for example, that, you know, the idea has been that wine traveled from Central Asia to Greece and then eventually to Italy, and the Greeks planted wine on what are today Italian territories. More recently, some research has suggested that there's evidence of vines or vineyard activity that predates Greek colonization of the Italian peninsula. So similarly with foods like this, we have texts that trace, you know, that we have Columbus's diaries and Vespucci's diaries that tell us what they were seeing and doing and the things they brought back with them. But we also have the issue of food being an easy commodity to exchange, especially in these first examples, these first iterations, where it's literally maybe a handful of stuff that they're just showing off as these exciting new things, right? So,
and the thing that sort of springs to mind when I'm thinking of, you know, corn reaching Italy is less at first as a food product and more as a botanical species to showcase and to kind of be obsessed with. And I'm reminded of the frescoes just down the hill in Rome at the Villa Farnesina, in which Raphael depicts squash and corn cobs and all sorts of like plump or phallic looking Mesoamerican ingredients as the sort of wreath garland frames of his famous fresco cycle on the ceiling of that noble palace.
You know, that's a favorite depiction of mine. It's a great place to visit when you are next in Rome. Everyone should go there. It's a beautiful, it's beautiful and exciting for many reasons. If you care about food, it's especially exciting, not only for the reasons that Katie's talking about, but also because it takes the walk between food and sex that we are often pointing towards, but not always getting to talk about here, because we're trying to focus on food mostly. Katie's like, no comment. Yeah. The example that you're talking about, though, is also perfect for us in terms of explaining what role this food would have had initially, right? It's exciting looking. It's different. It's new. Nobody knows exactly what to do with it. And
it's so shocking because in Mesoamerica, there were 150 zillion approaches to it that are utterly ignored, not to mention the way in which it could be processed to actually be healthy to eat.
Right. Which is right. Going to become the segue into the more pessimistic side of this that you're very excited about. But in the meantime, in the early modern period, corn, like tomatoes also, we know, and the squashes that you're talking about, are also sort of being used as a way to show people that you are in the know or you are well connected, right? It's the clubhouse invitation of the 1540s, right? You are someone who is aware of what is the cutting edge of news right now, what is on the cutting edge of culture as a result of that. So you're, you know, part of this elite getting new stuff from a new place that people didn't know about. And so, you know, that's what corn is initially representing more than food, its status and connectedness.
Totally. So it transcends that sort of Spanish funded exploration, enters Europe, and then essentially takes literal root in places that you might not expect. You know, we of course talk a lot about how the tomato is imported through Spain and then spreads to holdings of Spanish dominion. But in the south of Italy, where the Spanish ruled, there was really a lot less prevalence of corn, even, you know, throughout the times that it boomed in northern Italy. And it kind of seems to take hold in and around Venice, specifically with, I think, Venetian government intervention to cultivate it.
Yeah, that's it. That's dead on. It, you know, we could probably predict this based on the viability of the crop in the in these areas. We know that the south of Italy grows wheat relatively well, particularly as you go further south into Sicily. You are able to access wheat, which is always going to kind of trump all the other possibilities. It has the highest market value in the European context. And so if you can get wheat or you can grow it even better, you focus on that. And then you move away from that as it becomes more challenging or less, you know, viable for both growth reasons and economic ones. And so the center north of Italy, and particularly into the north east, where, as Venice can easily foreshadow for you, we have some swampy territory. We're looking, you know, at a space that requires a different crop, a different form of agriculture. People will have heard us talk about rice and risotto growing up and becoming more popular in this area as well. And that's what corn does, as you point out, Katie.
Yeah. And, you know, it does by, and correct me if I'm wrong on dates, by the 17th century, replace the sorghum and millet fields, and really is one of those major modern examples of monoculture that completely transforms the biodiversity of the, you know, Veneto and Lombardy by eliminating forests and other types of agricultural terrains, replacing it with cornfields.
Yes. And if speaking of, as you started us off with, Katie, the love that you have of corn, it's not tremendously surprising that corn initially, at least, seemed more attractive. It's sweet. It's naturally tastier. I mean, sorghum and millet do not the palate excite, right? It is something that is
I like sorghum.
I'm not trying to shit on your sorghum, okay?
It is easier to grow, it's more productive, and, you know, in spite of the fact that by a certain point in the 19th century, like, I think 80% of the Veneto's agricultural production was dedicated to it, it's not as though there was a great creativity dedicated to transforming it. And so it's cheap to use because it's, yeah. I mean, I'm not aware of other alternative uses, but it seems that the corn husks would be harvested, the kernels separated, dried, milled, and then you've got your cornmeal, which could be used in bread or polenta.
That's basically it. And, you know, to connect back to the comments about class and status and your ability to, you know, have access, corn starts off initially because of its natural productivity as animal feed, as fodder, right? And then it's shifted over to becoming as a result of the monoculturalization, the top food for anyone in the lower sects of society, in particularly the northeast of Italy, although also beyond that. And people in those spaces were not unaware of the fact that this was going to be a problem. For one thing, as you said, there wasn't a lot of creativity, and we can speculate for the reasons for that. There isn't necessarily one answer, but for one, it's, you know, it becomes very streamlined. As you said, it's easy to grow. It's fast. You know, take it and squeeze everything out of it very quickly in this way by moving it into cornmeal. And then it is easy to store for a long time, and it becomes a product that you can stretch and stretch and stretch for caloric value. But, you know, people in these spaces of the Northeast realized that they were being fed corn and only corn, and they were being told to grow corn and only corn, and creating a cycle that was problematic. And farmers know better than that, obviously, as they still do today. This isn't a good way to maintain an agricultural cycle.
Yeah, but it was a sort of capitalist-driven agrarian system that imposes the corn cultivation. And farmers, you know, when we think about farmers in Italy today, we think about various sizes, but generally, like, what comes to mind is a farmer who's in charge of what he or she is planting and overseeing land and bringing those items to market. But in the main production zones of corn in the 19th century, especially the Veneto, the vast majority of people living in that region were sharecroppers or day laborers. So they were not actually in control of what they were producing. They were assigned work. And really, like, their access to food was limited because of their low wages and because of their low status. And, you know, when we say, like, people only ate corn, that's not really an exaggeration. People were eating corn very, very, very regularly for breakfast, lunch, and dinner throughout the year.
Yeah. Yeah. And as you began to mention before, this has some really serious consequences. So there's the one side of it is how boring and how ultimately limited nutritionally that is, and, you know, all the kind of obvious superficial problems that result from that. But it turns out that one of the preparations, or one of the kind of initial modes of preparation for corn that comes from Mesoamerica, or that I should say inhabits the space of consumption of corn in Mesoamerica, did not make the transatlantic journey with the product. And that is nixtamalization, the process by which corn becomes not just more digestible, but releases several of its more important nutritional components. And the lack of use of techniques that might allow the corn to become nixtamalized, and there are a few different ways, but the way that we're familiar with here is by the pounding of the corn into mortar in the process that tortillas were made, and that is part of the traditional Mesoamerican diet. People in the Veneto are eating all this corn, and not only are they dying of boredom, they start dying malnutrition in a very specific way.
That's right. Yeah, if you don't undertake that transformation, what's the word that has niacin as its root?
Nixtamalization.
Yeah, you're not able to absorb the B3, aka niacin, compounds that are present in corn, and that's a really important vitamin for physical activity, whether it's hoeing a field or breastfeeding. Like, all of these energy exerting activities require niacin to function. And in the absence of niacin, people would exhibit all sorts of symptoms in increasing intensity. And what's the phrase, like the four D's? At first, you start to have this sort of like skin illness, or it looks like a little bit, dermatological symptoms. You start to get very sensitive to sunlight. You get redness, rashes, and blisters, a very sort of like leprosy evocative look to the skin. It was often, in fact, confused with leprosy. Because as you can imagine, in Italy in the 19th century, there wasn't a super highly developed system for diagnosing and treating illnesses like this. So they were often misdiagnosed or incorrectly identified. Digestive disorders, of course, would follow. Lots of like vomiting, abdominal pain, loss of appetite, constipation. And then once the niacin deficiency progressed even further, you would suffer neurological disorders of sort of varying length, and these tended to be like extremely painful psychologically and physically. You would just actually suffer physical pain, cramps, aches, pains, trembling, tingling, loss of feeling in the extremities, headaches, dizziness, and there was even the potential for epileptic convulsions, which then, you know, once you've suffered all of this living nightmare, the symptoms could further escalate to psychiatric disorders. And the symptoms of these are like, they sound the worst.
I mean, the list you gave is already pretty bad, but you're right.
That's bad? That's a walk in the park. Delirious hysteria, obsessive compulsive disorder, a propensity to suicide or homicide, listless wandering, bulimia, This is the one that is just like so heartbreaking. The compulsion to eat non like substances that also do not have nutrition, soil, sand, and lime.
Yeah, it's not good. I don't think most people imagine that a diet too high in corn could do all of those horrible things to you. It is furthermore, even worse than has already been outlined by Katie, because we're talking about this happening in a whole substantial piece of a population, right? So it's not a couple of kind of local communities relying too much on corn. It is a vast swath of the Northeast and central north of Italy, particularly in and around the Veneto, as Katie mentioned, but even extending beyond that. So you're looking at...
I mean, Umbria, Piedmont, Lombardy, Le Marche to some extent.
Absolutely. So this is affecting many, many thousands of people. We're not talking about a kind of strange offshoot or a community that got left behind in some way. We are talking about a big piece of the Italian population being affected by this. The least bad scenario is the malnutrition and the effects that you'll see there, which include mostly the dermatological conditions and then diarrhea and other digestive issues that are dehydrating, et cetera. I know it's like hilarious why they're all starting with D's, but anyway, that's how people have the mnemonic device for it. But the deterioration of the mind and the dementia that comes from it is something that not only has this immediate effect of the terror of seeing people falling apart physically and mentally in this way, but beyond that, create the need for a space for some kind of state apparatus or governing apparatus that helps, and I'll put that in scare quotes right now, this besieged population. And the response to this was essentially the building and proliferation in really kind of distressing ways of hospitals for the mentally disabled, which at the time operated mostly like prisons.
Exactly.
Or worse. Yeah.
So most of these were being implemented in the Veneto. And do we get a sense of, you know, what, I mean, obviously you know the answer to this. There's no getting a sense of it. Like there's a start and an end date. But by like the turn of the 20th century, or is it earlier that there starts to be like a more scientific approach and that people start identifying pellagra as a niacin deficiency? Because I know for years, and not just in Italy, but also in the southern United States, where 3 million people suffered also from pellagra, mainly African Americans, whose diets consisted mostly of cornmeal-based breads and grits. You know, this was something that would have just been sort of misidentified. And I know that Italian doctors and botanists believe that there was some like insect infestation that was causing it. They like couldn't figure out why Mesoamerican consumers were not suffering from this illness. They didn't connect it to the processing of corn and just assume that there was something sort of in the land or in the corn itself that was causing this. When did they identify this in Italy?
So they learn, again, much like they brought the corn from the U.S. or from what would become the U.S., they also find the solution there. It's in 1914, Joseph Goldberger discovers the cause in the context that you're talking about, in the overly corn dependent African-American diet of the Southeast of the United States, and understands that the issue is related to the lack of nixtamalization and the kind of missing step in the European use of corn, or the consumption of corn, rather. It takes some time after that for the pellagrosi, right? So Italy had, by that point, long identified the disease and actually created quite a bit of legislation around identifying people suffering from it and tracking cases, but they had not developed a, certainly not a cure and or really an effective treatment until the early part of the 20th century. And we're moving into World War I at that point. So, you know, you can imagine the tragic socioeconomic context that the northeast of Italy is facing at this point. Now, flash forward to 1978 when La Legge, what do we call it in English? The closing of mental institutions, as it's called in Italy, it's remembered as La Legge Basaglia because it's the person who passed the legislation requiring that all of these prison-like or even worse than that, almost, you know, almost human experimentation laboratory like apparent hospitals be closed, and a whole new system of mental health care put into effect. So you know, bookending it at around 150 years or so, even more like 200, of a monoculture taking over the space and then also kind of infiltrating life at every level. So if ever we have had an episode dedicated to a food with serious consequences in every walk of life, corn really speaks to it. So it is part of the reason why we kind of decided to pick up this particular food product as we were jumping back into our classic style Gola episodes, because it's, you know, corn lets us do all the things that we're interested in doing. It speaks to everything, politics, culture, economics, gender, because of course women were more likely to be locked into the manicomi than men, etc.
They were also more likely to be sufferers of pellagra because they not only, you know, had to undergo that, the energy driven process of gestating humans and then raising and breastfeeding them, but they also worked more days per year than men, right, or half the money. Sound familiar?
Yeah, I love making 82 cents on the dollar or less than that most of the time.
And so, yeah, so like women suffered much higher rates of pellagra in these periods as well. And I think it's also, you know, noteworthy, we're always connecting our episodes with like monoculture now threatening ecosystems in northern Lazio because the Ferrero Nutella production demands so much in the way of hazelnuts that, you know, forests with their great diversity are being torn out and replaced with, like, you know, Nutella farms, basically. These are, you know, not irrelevant topics to us. And plus, it's also notable that in the south of Italy, where, as you mentioned, wheat and olives and wine grapes would have been really important, viable agricultural products. Corn also grew, but it never had the same dominance because there was a diversity in the market and therefore in the ecosystem.
Absolutely. I feel like we spend a lot of time making sure everybody knows how dangerous corn is, but we should also comment on how delicious it can be and how it remains present in the Italian diet in a non-threatening way.
Yes. Right, so now we're talking, of course, about corn and tuna pizza. Corn.
The most classic after-hours snack of all time.
Okay, so this is one of the ways that you'll encounter corn in Italy. But I mean, honestly, you either find it in the form of cornmeal, which is used in polenta or different types of cornbread, or in the canned fashion when it's dumped into an insalatona, which is a very big salad, or accompanying tuna fish on pizza in Naples.
This is true. You do not find corn on the cob in Italy. It's not a thing. People don't eat it. They don't prepare it that way in their homes. They wouldn't. You don't find it. You certainly don't find it at the supermarket in cobs like that. You might, if you have a relationship with the farmer, be able to get it or know someone at the market who brings it to you that way. But as Katie says, basically you have these little mini cans of it that are like the nibs, right? Or niblets or whatever they're called. And or the other option is you have cornmeal. And that, of course, is by far the more common way of experiencing it. And there are many ways that that can be presented, even once we kind of move into the generic territory of polenta. Polenta is a universe unto itself. there are lots of ways that I enjoy polenta, but it will surprise no one to learn that I am, and I'm going to guess that Katie's on board with this, the best way to eat polenta is, of course, fried.
Yeah, duh. I mean, shout out to Bari for making that a thing. Yeah, so also polenta is, if I understand correctly, is now synonymous with a cornmeal sort of like situation, but that it would have been used to describe like similar preparations with other cereals. I also like fried polenta, but I also like polenta with pork ribs, you know, something you find a lot of like, I mean, all over the Apennines, in Abruzzo, Umbria, Le Marche, lots of central Italian regions, the like Sunday meal will be a bunch of little like pork bits cooked in tomato sauce, and then that sort of spooned over a pretty, like, I would say a pretty moist but compact polenta. That's generally how I encounter it texture-wise.
I think that's, yeah, I think that's about right. You have it as a probably a little bit soupier than most Americans would be familiar with if they're working with cornmeal to make something in the grits or, you know, adjacent family. I would say that the evocation of the Apennine is really important here, because I think that while polenta is obviously a product of the North, and especially Northeast, as we've established, it is strongly associated with mountain culture in general. And if you go hiking or skiing in Italy, you will almost always have your midday break at a rifugio, which will have for its lunch, or ultimately, if you also are spending the night, dinner offering a hearty dish of polenta with stewed meat in some way. And the polenta is a little bit looser, as Katie, you were describing, and it just kind of sucks up all of those rich juices. And it's delicious. I mean, it's delicious.
I just remembered that polenta with shrimp, like butter shrimp, basically, is like one of the classic dishes of Venice. Polenta,
yeah.
What's it called? Polenta con schiet.
Yeah, exactly.
Although, and I'm sure there's a proper Venetian pronunciation of that dialect word that I'm
bothering. It's always, well, so the Venetian takes us Spanish usually. So it's like chiave is chave, right? So you get it, you put the ch in places you wouldn't expect it in Italian. I love that, obviously. Anything that brings together, especially because those, you know, the weird little frutti di mare that you get in places like Venice that have this incredibly elaborate culture of taking absolutely everything they can from the sea or the Gulf is always just absolutely a delight and super delicious. But also it's bringing in the kind of other component there that I want to point out that might not jump out to the consumer immediately is the presence of butter, right? So using animal fats and especially butter in a place where you can get a lot of butter. And as you move away from the coast into areas that we know now to be associated with butter production and dairy, that then create a product that's a little bit different, because you're having your base starch as something that is not only corn rather than wheat or other grain driven, but also using a lipid that isn't necessarily the most obvious component in an Italian dish. So it's a great kind of point of contrast in the world of, you know, classic primi or secondi.
There's also, just related to Venice, a town in the Black Sea, Trabzon, on the northern Turkish coast that does polenta with like a cheese that's very similar to bito. So like a super delicious, gooey, oozy melter, which is logical because Venetians had, you know, all sorts of commercial interests in the Black Sea centuries ago. So shout out to the Venetians for exporting a delicious cheesy dish.
Thank you, Venice.
Oh, happy birthday too.
Yeah. Well, that's now I'm distracted because I'm just thinking about how I'd really like to have a vacation on the Turkish coast.
Oh my God. As soon as humanly possible. So bad.
Anyway.
I think you're
summer 2021
with a negative test.
Yeah, I actually know that. And as you know, because we discussed it before recording today, I am nearly fully vaccinated. So I will, in short order, be joining you on the other side of the Atlantic and hopefully frolicking with many other friends who have safely managed to navigate this year of pandemic and gotten themselves protected with vaccination and other PPE.
Just purely based on the contents of my inbox, I want to preemptively add that although Danielle is vaccinated, tourism is not allowed in Italy. She can come here for work, but once you're vaccinated, you are not welcome in Italy just by virtue of the fact that you're vaccinated. We currently have 3 million vaccinated people in a country of 61 million, and about 9% of septuagenarians have been vaccinated. We think we'll be in good shape when that number is closer to 100%. So stay tuned for updates through 2025.
Yes, thank you, Katie. And that is a very important thing and a perfect place for us to conclude, because all of the things that we talk about here on Angola are directed towards encouraging people to get to Italy and many other places and enjoy experimenting with food culture and people through the on-site and in-person experience. But we also have to continue to be really careful and really aware of the fact that our own safety is one step, but the safety of others is another equally important step that has to be taken. And Italy isn't in a position right now. You and I are come to Italy with residency documents and with a need to do work in that place that makes it slightly different than going just to have fun. We can't wait for all of our golosi to be able to come and have fun with us. And honestly, if you think you're really desperate, you can't imagine how desperate we are for that. But we're hoping it will be sooner rather than later. And we'll keep everybody updated as we keep our podcast coming out. And speaking of, Katie, what else should people be looking for coming out besides new episodes of Gola?
Well, I've got a really fun Demi community going. It's at the moment a WhatsApp group, and you join for $10 a month. There's a different theme every week. This week we're doing Easter and Passover recipes, and we just kind of like exchange thoughts and picks, and I jump on Zoom once a month and we do like a pizza lesson or focaccia lesson. It's a really fun interactive thing. Just think of it as like a hangout with 100 friends you haven't met yet. And they all love pasta as much as you do. And they all think Italy's great and can't wait to get there. What else is cooking? You got stuff happening?
What do I have happening? I have the usual things happening. I'm working on a variety of different publications and projects for my Italian studies research Dartmouth now. I'm amping up for a fall program with my undergraduate students in fall, fall program, there you go, with my undergraduate students in Rome. That's more important, where I can't wait to be spending time doing research on site with you, Katie Partla. And I am still doing tons of, I have to say that the last week I did about 3 or 4 Italian wine tastings on the Zoom. And I think they're getting better, actually. I think everybody's getting better at it, probably. We're all more familiar with the format. We're all kind of a little looser. The weather's been getting better most places as spring is springing. And I would, you know, encourage everyone to reach out. Katie does tons of them as well. It's just a really nice way to get together. And we'll have more Gola events, but it's been nice to see people who listen to us or work with us in a variety of ways get together and have a toast and just have more increasingly dynamic conversations about what we're drinking or eating together in those formats. So, you know, they should get in touch with either one or both of us through our usual channels. I'm at Dr. Caligari's Cabinet on Insta. Katie, where can they find you?
I'm at Katie Parla on all the social medias.
on all the medias. And if you like this podcast, as we told you at the top, so many of you do, so many of you are giving us money. We love you so, so much. We appreciate it. It keeps us going. It makes us exist. If you know other people who want to do that too, let them know that they can find us on patreon.com/golapod and listen to us and subscribe and rate us on any of the podcast platforms that they prefer to use.
And just to be clear, you're not giving us money. You're giving us money to give to Squadcast and other cool ways to.
Yeah. Katie and I are not going out eating our delicious dishes of polenta with butter shrimp.
Yeah. And I'll just hold a microphone with my own money. Yeah.
Our golden microphones came from a separate and important account. It's none of your business where we're laundering that money from. Absolutely. No, we so, so truly appreciate it. And we will continue to give you more and better quality podcast content as you continue to support us. Grazie golosi. Ci vediamo presto. Arrivederci.
We love you. Ciao.